This is Phil Pritchett. Welcome to the P2 Podcast.
There's never been a better time than right now to be a musician.
Jenny hit Austin.
My name's Phil, and I just want to play rock and roll, man.
Tougher than the rest.
Fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. It is your old friend Phil Pritchett here on the P2 Podcast. Broadcasting worldwide in beautiful high-definition audio or something quite like it. To all corners of the globe, to all ships at sea of this bluish-green planet of ours. Preaching the P2 Gospel to all willing souls abroad and here in the lovely United States. How's everybody doing out there? Phil Pritchett here, sitting atop my perch at Trinidad World Recording Studios in beautiful Fort Worth, Texas, on a cold, rainy afternoon, the kind that makes for great podcasting and great rock and roll. Oh, did anyone ever write a great song on a beach? Don't tell me about Jimmy Buffett. Garbage. All great music was written in a freezing cold cabin in Minnesota or somewhere. That's where Dylan and everybody came from. Neil Young's from Canada. That's where a lot of your great tunes come from. The band up there at their house, Big Pink, chopping firewood and freezing in the basement, just trying to write the last waltz, you know. I'm sorry, music from Big Pink. Last Waltz, of course, the movie with all of them in it. Talking about chopping wood and fixing the screen door. Well, Phil is here, folks. Well, man, I mentioned this just offhandedly in one of the first newsletters that we have re-resurrected here. Anti-Facebook and Twitter, where I can only put a couple little things on there. Hey, how's everybody doing? Blah. I've gone back to the old newsletter list that I have not enacted in a long time. If you'd like to unsubscribe, let me know. But I got very few unsubscribes and a lot of people signing up. PhilPritchett.com. Just click the newsletter thing and sign in. You get a free email letter update thing from me a couple times a month. I mentioned I've been watching The Godfather in my mail out, and that got me to thinking. I was like, you know, the lessons of The Godfather. Why do we watch The Godfather? I watched it with one of my older kids, teenager now, and she was, intrigued with it, disturbed by it. She's like, well, how come this movie, I mean, I like it, but how come this is a movie that people keep going back to? And she's very interested in films herself, and I didn't know how to answer it. I grappled for an answer. Why is The Godfather so compelling where other, you know, mafia movies are not? So that leads us to this segment. Wait, what? Can you hear that? Ah, turn it up. I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse. I'll handle it, Pop. That's my family, Kay. Not me. A man who doesn't spend time with his family can never be a real man. That's P2, little Godfather impression. Huh? That's my Don Corleone and my Michael Corleone there. How it sometimes plays at parties. I'm doing my best here. Lessons of the Godfather, man. Lessons of the Godfather. Of course, the great Francis Ford Coppola film. I think the first one was 1971, based on the book by Mario Puzo. Oh, man. You know, I went to a little college there in Georgetown, Texas, Southwestern University. I sign up for American history. Or American government, I think it was. And with the great Timothy J. O'Neill, a very respected, one of the few conservative kind of professors on the campus, went in there, and so I'm expecting law books or government books. I'm like, oh, great. He says, well, the first book we're going to read is The Godfather. I'm just like, what? Now, I wasn't that into The Godfather coming out of high school. I had seen it, and I liked it. You know, I liked the action and the this and that. And I was like, oh, yeah, you know, The Godfather, sure. I don't think I'd read the book at that point. But the reason we're reading that in a government class, why are you doing that, Phil? Well, remember in the film, killing the Turk and the cop in the restaurant, that famous scene, Michael comes out of the bathroom with the gun. Well, he's exiled in Sicily till it all blows over. Then he comes back to the United States wearing all black. He hunts down Kay, Diane Keaton, his old girlfriend, and tries to get her to take him back. And he utters the immortal line, just, Kay, my father is no different than any other powerful man. And Kay looks at him and says, Michael, you know how naive you sound. And Michael says something like, he's no different than a congressman or a senator. She says, Michael, congressmen and senators don't have men killed. And Michael just stares at her coldly and says, now who's being naive, Kay? Cue the music! But that brings us all to an important point. And the reason we read that book in college, and this really stuck with me, is O'Neill talked about the three forms of power. The three forms of power. This is what we study. The Godfather exemplifies them all very, very well, the book and the film. Here they are. Coercion, reciprocity, persuasion. I'm thinking, what? But think about it. Persuasion. You have the respect, the ability to persuade someone to do what you want. We're talking about power. You try to get someone to do what you want. You persuade them to do something. If that doesn't work, there's reciprocity, reciprocal relationship. You do this for me, I'll do this for you. And then finally, only when necessary, coercion. Put a gun to their head. Either your brains or your signature is going to be on the contract. What's it going to be? Coercion. This is how Don Corleone, the wise and great Don Corleone, Marlon Brando, of course, playing Don Corleone in The Godfather, this is his true power. It's not that he is just a thug. In fact, if you watch The Godfather Part 2 and you learn Robert De Niro, the young Don, how he comes to respect, he comes to respect by being a likable and man of respect in the neighborhood there. But he kills the black hand, the local Don, Don Fanucci, I think his name was, who's just kind of a thug. He'd walk into the grocery store and stick his hand in the cash registers. You owe me money. Ah, I protect you. And kind of protection money, that kind of stuff. But that gets you nowhere. Everybody hates you and all that. The young Don sees this and he realizes that true power comes with respect, with not even having to say anything to get your way. And so the Don refuses presents from people who try to give him things. And the young Don says, no, 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 I'll return that favor. And becomes a great man of respect. So these are the three forms of power the young Don begins to wield. Persuasion, reciprocity, coercion, only as a last resort. That is illustrated very well at the beginning of the first Godfather film, where Don Corleone's godson, Johnny Fontaine, sort of a Frank Sinatra kind of singer, comes back to ask the Don a favor. He goes, I can't get this part in the movie, Godfather. This guy out in Hollywood won't give it to me. And the Godfather slaps him around a little bit. Start acting like a man, you know. And so the Don sends Tom Hagen, Robert Duvall, his adopted child and current consigliere, his attorney, out to L.A. to talk to this big head of the studio, Mr. Waltz. Is it Waltz? I think it's Waltz Movies. To talk to Waltz about letting Johnny into the movie. And here we see our three forms of power take place. Does Hagen go out there as maybe the thug in the second Godfather movie, the old local black hand that Don did, the young Don knocked off? Did he just muscle the guy right up front? No, 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 no. Duvall goes out there. He shakes his hands. I enjoy your pictures very much. I'm here to talk to you. He doesn't mention who he's representing. He says, I work for one client. I'm here to see that Johnny Fontaine gets the role in that picture. And Wolf is just thinking, who is this guy? You know, just absolutely not. Whatever, you know, you're coming out here trying to muscle me, you know. And Hagen, persuasion's not working. So he goes to the second tier, reciprocity. It's like, why should I do that for you? And Hagen says, well, you're going to have some union trouble coming up in the coming months. My client can make that go away. And then Wolf gets really upset and goes, what are you, some sort of, you know, Italian guy coming out here trying to, all that kind of stuff. So Hagen has tried persuasion. He has tried reciprocity. You know, persuade Johnny to get the part. Reciprocity. Give him the part. We'll do this for you. Waltz finally figures out that he's working for Don Corleone, who name anybody in the industry evidently knows. So he invites Tom to dinner and says, how come you said you didn't work for Corleone? You didn't tell me you worked for Corleone, Tom. He's like, well, I don't like to use his name unless it's absolutely necessary. But then Wolfs goes into a tirade about why Johnny Fontaine will never get that picture. You know, he stole this girl I had. She was going to make her a big star, and I'll be even more frank. You know, he gets all upset, tells Hagen to get the hell out of here. So Hagen just wipes his mouth. Just Don Corleone is a man who insists on hearing bad news immediately. Thank you for the dinner, and I enjoy your pictures very much. And leaves, and Wolfs is like, what? Failure of persuasion, failure of reciprocity. Well... And one of the most famous cinematic scenes ever. The next morning, cue the music, someone. We start with a wide shot of the Wolf's mansion. Of Wolf's mansion. We move in. We move in. We go right through the window, right into Wolf's bedroom. We come up on the bed. There's a sleeping Jack Waltz in the bed. He's tossing and turning. He kind of wakes up. Of course, the blood is all over his hands. He's, what? He pulls back the sheets, and what's in there, man? The prized thoroughbred horse that he had shown to Tom Hagen. The head of a $600,000 animal that he loved more than life itself. In his bed, Waltz screams in horror. Coercion. You couldn't persuade him. You couldn't deal with him reasonably. You couldn't do anything for him. Well, then you get a horse head in your bed. And then later in the movie, Don Corleone walks into his office and there's all these flowers there. And he's like, well, what's all this? What's all this? Hagen goes, well, you know, Johnny's in that new movie out there in California. And you know, Corleone just kind of shrugs and goes, well, get rid of him, you know. Don Corleone always gets his way. There's a great scene in... So those are three forms of power. And we related it to, you know, power in the U.S. Senate. So that was my government class. It was really interesting how my professor played... You know, the forms of power in The Godfather displayed how he could persuade people and reciprocate was really the true source of the Don's power. And then, of course, he was ruthless. So when the Don came to you, it got out real quickly that when the Don came to you and asked for a favor, I know how to return a favor, as De Niro tells someone, you know, tells people in the second Godfather. When he comes to you and asks for something, you know damn well this is your last chance. He's trying to persuade you to do something. Maybe if you have cold feet, he reciprocates. Hey, I'll do this for you if you do this for me. And you damn sure better do it because the reputation is out there. The horse in the horse's head in the sheets and so forth. So, you know, how does that apply to our modern day politics? Oh, I fear very closely. The whole epic, what's so appealing about The Godfather is, you know, the Italians were greatly discriminated against at the turn of the century, 18th, 19th century. Vito Corleone, the Don, he came over on a boat as an orphan with smallpox, 9 years old. You know, how's the guy ever, and he was determined to make a good life for himself here in the United States, but he knew darn well he couldn't depend on a bunch of wealthy guys from Ivy League schools or whatever to give him a hand. He was never going to become a wealthy businessman or a congressman or senator or something like that. So he had to just kind of build his reputation and build his street smarts in the street, and he didn't do that by muscling people around and jerking people around. You know, like Bob Dylan's song says, to live outside the law, you must be honest. Don Corleone was always honest, always kept his word. When have I ever refused anyone an accommodation? He always was willing to play ball if it was in his interest and his family's interest. As long as your interests don't conflict with mine. And that's how it went, man. The Godfather. Persuasion, reciprocity, coercion. So when the Don comes to you, like he does to the Undertaker, who the Don does a favor for, when the Don's son, Sonny Corleone, is killed, and he wants Sonny to look decent for his funeral, he brings his son's bullet-riddled body to the Undertaker. And Tom Hagen calls ahead. Your godfather is coming to you to provide a service for him, and he has no doubt that you will happily perform this service for him. And, of course, that undertaker in the middle of the night, he's standing there in full tuxedo, ready to do the Don this service. Yeah, when Corleone comes in to have his son made up for the funeral. Intense stuff. And the whole appeal of it is the family, man. You've got Don Corleone, then you have his three sons, Sonny, Fredo, and Michael, and then the youngest girl, Connie. It always revolves around family. The Don always is trying to make a better life for his family. Of course, there's many horrors he commits. But for some reason, man, years and years and years later, watching the movie, you start to see Don Corleone's actions and his motives as pure in some really, really weird sense that you don't want to admit to. You know, people always talk about Goodfellas, Scorsese mafia films. And in my opinion, they just, you know, I mean, it's a good movie. It's a fast movie. Goodfellas, I mean, it's just excessively violent, but there's nothing, there's just no humanity in it. These guys, everyone in the movie is just totally deplorable, and hateful, and just, it's an ugly movie. And I know that's the whole point, Phil. I'm like, I know, but it's ugly. It's ugly, ugly, terrible. It's awful people doing awful things. And only a short-sighted person, I think, would say that about the Godfather movies. Yes, they're awful people doing awful things, but they're also they're beautifully filmed, beautiful music, fantastic acting, and the family element in it. And the Don talking about congressmen and senators, they're the puppet masters, you know. And the Don just said, I refuse to be a fool, to dance on the strings held by all those big shots. He knew if he wanted to make his own way in the world, he'd have to live outside the law. And he was willing to do that to make a better life for him and his family. Aren't we all that way? Maybe not willing to live outside the law, but we're all trying to find a way to improve our lives. And we certainly have, a lot of us have opportunities to do that in many ways. That the young Vito Corleone coming over here as a sick orphan certainly did not. That does not excuse his violent behavior, of course. But the violent behavior, he would argue, only came after the man would not be reasonable. Persuasion and reciprocity had failed, and you had wronged Don Corleone for no reasonable reason. So, The Godfather. Cue the music! I just get chills when I hear the music, man. Well, well, well. So give me some feedback on this Godfather stuff. Love to hear if it resonates with any of you out there. It's something that I always revisit a lot. Great, great stuff. Beautiful films, and they appeal to me in many ways as the years go by. Watching it 100 times, I never get tired of it. Well, Luke Coffey, film director. Speaking of great films, we're going to have Luke Coffey in here talking about his life in movies. He works over there in Dallas. Coffey Productions, he's made a film called Language of a Broken Heart. It's been on the festival circuit in Europe and in the United States. They got some distribution deals happening on that. Very exciting. And also in Phil Pritchett news, he's the guy behind the Carroll Tigers documentary, the Old Man Football documentary that I've helped them with. I've done all the music for. So we'll talk about that in this segment, or next week. He'll be here for a couple of weeks. So stay tuned, folks. Luke Coffey is next. Fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. It is Phil Pritchett here on the P2 Podcast from beautiful Trinidad World Recording Studios, my beautiful studio here in Fort Worth, broadcasting in high-definition audio, or something quite like it, to all four corners of the globe, all the ships at sea. Fans, you know where to go for all the latest and greatest Pritchett News, thoughts and opinions and about this life we live in, this artistic world that we try to make sense of here in the internet era where everything is free and flying around. And so to help us make sense of a part of the entertainment industry that is increasingly in flux, floating around in uncertainty, my good friend and colleague, director, actor, producer, and a guy we've been working on some projects with. I've talked to you a lot about the old man football movie I'm doing with these guys. The venerable Luke Coffey has dropped by today.
Well, hello, Phil.
Down from his perch in Dallas, Texas, over there at Rock House Films. Coffey Productions. Luke is, I remember Luke from years and years and years ago. I remember the name of you being I was a referee at the YMCA there in Dallas, Texas.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember this young Coffey kid who would take the ball and run for a touchdown 60 yards every time he touched the ball. So you wanted to ref those Luke Coffey games. I go, man, that Coffey kid, he can score from anywhere on the field.
Oh, Phil.
Was that
was your pinnacle, unfortunately.
That was the pinnacle of your sports career?
Yes, it was. And I think my academic career as well. It went all straight down from there.
University Park was the end of it, huh?
That was. The Maroon Warriors. That was the glory times.
So how does a young football player like yourself chuck it all in and get into acting? What was your first foray into acting? How'd you get into acting? Were you in high school plays and stuff like that? Or
funny you say that, Phil. No, I did a little play in my first grade class. It was actually a talent show, and I did a Lionel Richie Dancing on the Ceiling lip sync.
Oh, nice!
And it was a big success in my small elementary school.
That was that first swell of just applause and the lights. Just the
it was on stage.
You're sweating, just going, this is great.
No, I think I like the glory part of all the whole thing, but of sports and anyway. So
that was your first taste of kind of the
that
stage.
That was my taste of
performing
the lights.
Yes,
and then I heard on the radio that Dick Clark was doing a new show called Putting on the Hits.
Oh, now this is still in your youth, first grade.
And I remember driving with my parents, and it came on the radio that they were having it Irving Mall
auditions
for it was kind of a Star Search, but lip sync.
I see
Star Search. This is online, by the way.
And your parents knew that we have this gifted child who can lip sync.
Yeah,
with
Lionel
anything.
Richie.
Yes.
Yeah. So
living proof.
Yeah, exactly.
So you drive out to the Irving Mall or wherever it was.
I did.
Oh,
and
God.
And there were it was just kind of a cattle call type deal, and they had us, but they had us come on stage, and there were the mall patrons watching the auditions.
Yeah.
And so somehow. There was, I think, something like 500 people.
Do the same Lionel Richie song?
Did the same, yeah.
You did your act.
Choreographed. Yeah, same act. Same act. Same outfit. White blazer. and I think I was 7 years old. So I, next day, I ended up making the top 20 in Dallas. So they had us come back.
Out
of 500. So, it was quite an experience. So that kind of, I got wet my whistle for
live performance.
Yes.
Did this sort of activity continue? Were you in plays, interested in films, acting?
I was, I'd make films. I was very interested in the film production side of growing up as a little kid. And
you were in the golden age of sort of the handheld video camera that was now common in
the VHS.
Most households. Yeah,
the VHS, the big,
Tapes.
Yeah, the big tapes.
On the shoulder.
And my dad got it for home movies, and I, decided to make some films. So the first film we made at my ranch, I'd employ my, siblings and my cousins.
Unwillingly.
Yeah, unwillingly, actors. And, and we shot Indiana Jones and the Last Cowpatty was the first film.
Yes, okay. Full-length feature.
Full-length feature. Yeah, 5 minutes long.
Were there any graphic violence in it?
There was
ketchup squirting, that kind of thing.
There was definitely some ketchup squirting. We were, I was.
That was a great technique, just this from behind the camera.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah,
red ketchup squirting.
There was a chase scene with my brother played Indiana, and he was riding a horse chasing the villain, my cousin, on a four-wheeler.
Yeah.
And he jumps off and grabs the rope and drags from behind.
That's an insurance nightmare you got out there.
I know it.
That would never pass the muster today.
I know it.
That kind of shoot would never be approved by any parents out there.
It would not.
So how did you get into... you know, in high school, what about high school?
High school was sports, more or less.
Sports, okay,
yeah,
okay.
I mean, I kind of, that football, you know, was my lot. Track and football, I cared more about that during the time. But then we had offered at our high school, Highland Park, we had a TV program, which, so that kind of got my interest back into
the
film side.
In the TV on the cart when we were going to watch a Jacques Cousteau movie in science or something?
No.
Was that you?
No, that was our, what was that?
That was a program of some
kind.
Yeah,
that was some kind of program. Yeah. We had a...
All you jocks were in there.
Yeah, exactly. we had a cable channel.
I remember that.
That was a little after me,
but yeah.
Yeah. We had a concept we came up called called School Zone.
Y'all made a show like every week.
Every show was like a magazine style.
It was on
like
Channel 16 or something.
Yeah.
On local cable.
We all were the reporters / producers and editors, the whole thing. So we'd make our own little segments. So, yeah. And then I did the last. I mean, last thing I really did in high school, I did our senior play, and then. MC'd our senior talent show. And
what play did y'all do? You remember?
You Can't Take It With You.
I don't know that one. Yeah. I know the title, but yeah. I don't know.
I can tell you what the story's about.
Oh, all right.
I don't remember.
So you MC'd the
senior talent show.
That's a big gig.
Yeah.
That's a big gig.
We wrote, it was two other guys and I.
Had to come up with some shtick.
Some little skits.
Hans and Franz or something.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I closed it with Heal the World, Make It a Better Place. Michael Jackson came out as Michael Jackson.
Yeah. The gloved one dancing.
Exactly. And we had, you know, all the nations represented coming out with lighters. That's kind of how we closed the whole
thing. So after, so your enthusiasm for acting, what kind of films were you into? Just the normal sort of, we were kind of talking before we came on the air. What were some of the first movies maybe you remembered seeing that were... You know, outside of just, I went to the movie with my friends and it was funny. I don't know. Was something about films or certain films starting to hit you at a high school, those formative years, you know?
I was just intrigued, I think, about thinking about, like, the fact that, you know, as a kid growing up, I never really saw it as how did they create those rather than, like, totally paying attention to the story. I definitely appreciated the story, but I wanted to know how did they do the production, the effects maybe.
Yeah.
And was intrigued by the acting, and it's like that this is not actually reality.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So I liked though that I could definitely be totally engulfed by the story and thought it was so intriguing that you can make this medium that people can totally be captivated for 2 hours at a time and escape their reality and go into this reality.
Their mundane existence.
Yeah. And go behind the smoke and mirrors and see this, this story that is not reality.
You were infected with movie magic.
Exactly.
The movie magic, yes.
Exactly. And it's crazy. Most people don't know what they wanted to be when they're a little kid, but I knew I wanted to be a filmmaker. And the acting kind of just... All elements of it kind of took off at different times. So
yeah, different opportunities came your way. Well, your company now, Coffee Productions, there in Dallas, y'all do a number of brand films. You've done tons of different commercials and things like that. Documentary films, feature films. You did your first big feature film here recently.
Yeah.
Tell us a little about that. I saw it recently.
Yep. It's called Language of Broken Heart. It's called, it's actually a rom-com. Rom-com, as they call it, a romantic comedy. Yes, exactly.
Yes.
It's never thought my first feature would be a romantic comedy.
And you're in the film as well. You have a part.
I do have a small part. You wrote yourself
into there. So if we're gonna produce this thing,
I started off just getting cast in it, and then was asked to come on as producer, which. Yes, I didn't write myself in.
Well, it's a very good movie. I saw it. I knew that your partner on the project, Rocky Powell, directed it.
Mm-hmm.
And man, I was very impressed with it. I understand you've got it. It's going to have a theatrical release here.
We're hoping, yeah, for a summer theatrical release in a good amount of cities. And it will kind of be dependent on how it does. But we're very hopeful. It's a cute little movie with a great story. And we've got some actors that you'll definitely recognize in there. So we're excited about it. Great music. It's got kind of – we were – going for kind of a Garden State type soundtrack, and let that kind of fuel the movie as well. But I mean, it's kind of a story about a guy that is
he's a novelist.
He's a novelist who is kind of built more like a female,
right,
than he is a male.
As they say in the film, he's the only guy they know who dreams about his own wedding.
Exactly. They're
very telling about the character. That was funny. He writes these novels about falling in love, yet his own love life has been a disaster.
Exactly.
That's kind of the
yes, he.
Am I right? I don't mean to sum it up.
Yes, he's pretty much a hypocrite when it comes to his writing, because what he's preaching is not working.
Right. But they eat it up reading about it.
Right, exactly. The women love him and think everything that the moves that he's making with his love life, you know, that every woman would really like that. But when it comes down to it, I think sometimes the statement that women fall for assholes is pretty true, because you know, sometimes don't want the meek, sensitive guy, which Juddie Tault, our lead actor / writer and my co-producer, plays.
Yeah.
And the reality of it is he is very much like that role.
That's right. wasn't a stretch for him to play.
Not a big stretch.
Well, I enjoyed it. Well, look for that film, Language of a Broken Heart. I know you've already been on the festival circuit in Europe and elsewhere. And you went out to the, which one, L.A. I went out to? Hollywood Film Festival?
We won the Best Picture in California Independent Film Festival. We just were in the Hollywood Film Festival several months ago.
Yeah.
And we were in the Dallas International Film Festival recently. And it's kind of, we could put it in some more festivals, but we've kind of...
You've kind of already got some options to move.
Yeah, we've got some options to move forward with, and we're ready to move on.
Yeah. So. Well, man, fans, it is your treat and mine as Luke Coffey, film director, actor, producer, talking about films, talking about all of his projects and unique experiences, acting all over the world, shooting films. He will be joining us next week if he'd be so kind to drop by again. We're going to continue our discussion, maybe talk a little more about the film I've been working on with him, Old Man Football, about those Carroll Tigers down there and all the 40-year-old guys going down there to play against the young 20-year-old guys. And Phil Pritchett just digging around for music that suits this documentary. It's coming along. We'll talk about that more in depth next week. Thanks for dropping by, Luke.
Hey, Phil, we're blessed to have you part of all our projects, and I'm just blessed to call you my friend.
Well, I'll cut the crap. Luke Coffey will be back next week. Well, folks, that's all the time we have here on the podcast. Thanks for listening. Call me, 817-733-5256, or email me, phil@philpritchett.com. To book the full band wherever you may be, in your backyard, a festival, or I don't know, out at your ranch or something, the full band will be there. And bands, as always, come see me at the studio. We'll make your record here better than anybody else can. phil@philpritchett.com. We'll see everybody next week on the podcast, same time. Be good to each other out there. Much tougher.